KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
From KCRW, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business. Director Shaunak Sen is Oscar-nominated for All That Breathes, his film about two brothers who run a bird hospital in India. He says it's hard enough to get financing for documentary films, but keeping creative control is even harder.
Money is almost never without a caveat, especially for an early career filmmaker. It's super important, at least for me at any rate, is to hold on to creative sovereignty. And therefore, you have to listen to the smaller, tiny voices in your head, which gets difficult if you don't have contractual autonomy.
Shaunak Sen talks about how a simple Google search led him to the brothers in his film and explains why he scrapped 8 months' worth of footage midway through the shoot. The work paid off. His film won big at Sundance and Cannes. But first we banter. Stick around. It's The Business from KCRW. I'm joined by my partner in banter, Matt Bellany. Hello, Matt.
Hi there.
So, as you have reported in a very interesting piece for Puck, there is a big question about the big TV hit Yellowstone, which is in limbo right now because Kevin Costner, who is a little bit important to that show, is doing what stars sometimes do. And Kevin Costner is, you know, more than a star. He's an Oscar-winning director. But Kevin Costner, whose career as an actor had been a little sleepy before the show brought him back. And, you know, who knows how he felt about that, but it appears that he is feeling that maybe he doesn't want to be doing all the Yellowstone stuff anymore.
Well, there's certainly a standoff right now. The show is in limbo because Costner has decided that he would like to direct the second of two Western films that he is very passionate about this summer. And he's only providing a small window of availability to come back to shoot Yellowstone. And there are various reasons why that show has been delayed and is not on the schedule that he originally thought it was going to be on. But it gets to the point now where there is such animosity between Kevin Costner's team and the producers that they are ready to move on and finish up this version of Yellowstone this season with or without him, and then do another version, potentially with Matthew McConaughey, that would start after this season of Yellowstone. And that's a real risk because we're talking about the number one show in television right now. More people watch Yellowstone on linear TV than any other show. And it has spawned a litany of spinoffs that are incredibly important to the Paramount streaming service, Paramount Plus. So if you take that anchor out of the Yellowstone franchise, the anchor being Costner, the question is, does the rest of this endeavor suffer?
Well, they have launched the shows without him, so they're not as big, but they exist. I think Taylor Sheridan, you know, who is the fountain of all of these things and who seems to be an inexhaustible source of material, like just one thing after another after another, we have reason to believe he's not the easiest guy in the world either.
Definitely not.
Definitely not. And Kevin Costner also maybe not the easiest guy. So this may be an example of two strong-willed people who are not going to be able to come to terms.
No, and that is probably the likely scenario here. And I have been told that Sheridan is pretty upset right now because he's in this limbo where he can't write the final episodes of this season 5 of Yellowstone without knowing whether the star of the show is going to be in them or not. And that's a really weird place to be. But you could make a strong argument that the Yellowstone franchise has outgrown Kevin Costner. It is so big now, and they've launched 1883 and 1923 with Helen Mirren and Harrison Ford, and they've got prequels that are planned every 20 years leading up to the present time, and they've got other spinoffs and huge stars that Sheridan is working with, like Stallone, and he's got, you know, a Nicole Kidman show and a bunch of other things in this so-called Sheridan universe, that they don't need Kevin Costner. And if they can put a bunch of the core Yellowstone cast onto a new show with someone like Matthew McConaughey, that would not only be a way to revitalize the show, but it would get them out of this very onerous Peacock deal. Because if you remember, the digital rights to Yellowstone in the U.S. were sold to Peacock, the NBC Universal streamer, not to Paramount Plus. So the sequels and all of the spinoffs are on Paramount Plus, but the original show is on Peacock, and Paramount would very much like to remedy that situation.
I'm sure they would. I'm holding out for the Stone Ages edition, you know, where they really go back.
The cavemen of the Dutton family?
Yes, the cavemen of the Dutton family. You could get some guys in some loincloths and who knows what might happen. I will note that Kevin Costner is among the highest paid stars on television. He's also done a lot of investing and he owns a lot of real estate and he's wheeling and dealing. So he's not like holding a tin cup looking for more. He can afford to do without it. But most people like money when it's on offer.
Certainly, about $20 million a season. I mean, he's making $1.2 million per episode, according to my sources. And he additionally has an overall deal with the studio behind Yellowstone, which pays him more. And they were going to do 16 episodes this season. So if you do the math, that's about $20 million per season. And he was going to make more if they go to a season six. So this is a pretty lucrative show for him. And the sad thing is there was a path for him to kind of gracefully ease out. He wants to direct other movies. He's now got some cachet to do so. These movies, Horizon, which he's very passionate about and have been developing a long time. He could have done those while also easing gracefully out of Yellowstone. But the animosity between him and the producers and the executives at Paramount and Taylor Sheridan, it's going to be a very difficult hurdle to overcome to get him back on that show at this point.
And as you say, it's not some kind of dignified, planned fade out. It's ugliness. And maybe that's just the way he rolls. I don't know. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany, a founding partner of Puck News. At just 24 years old, Indian filmmaker Shaunak Sen has already made two critically acclaimed feature-length documentaries. His most recent work, All That Breathes, won awards at both Sundance and Cannes, and it's now in contention for an Academy Award. Sen's debut film, the 2016 feature Cities of Sleep, explored the challenges that unsheltered people in Delhi face just in finding a safe place to bed down for the night. In Sen's latest film, All That Breathes, haunting shots of smog-filled landscapes reveal the ecological crisis in Delhi, where the air is so polluted that sometimes a black kite, a majestic bird of prey, simply falls from the sky. The film follows brothers Mohammed and Nadim, who run a bird clinic in their basement, where they've treated more than 20,000 birds. The kite is a traditional bird. Every life form adjusts to the city now. Rats, pigs, frogs, mosquitoes, turtles, insects, cows and horses. All improvise and adapt to the city. Congratulations on, you won a lot of awards and now you're nominated for Oscar. So that's, I imagine that's quite exciting.
You imagine correctly. It is, given how we started and where we began, this is a kind of galaxy that is entirely unfathomable, honestly, to us. And of course, it's difficult to wrap one's head around it. And we're obviously besides ourselves with relief and joy.
Yes, I should think so. And you can describe where you started. I know that you've talked about the derelict basement where you started filming. You're not gilding the lily, I should say. Both in your depiction of Delhi and the circumstances where these brothers were working. I've never been to Delhi, but having seen your movie, I feel like I've had a visit there. You're not exactly doing this as a travel promotion. It's a very unsparing look at what is beautiful and what is not so beautiful.
Well, Delhi, like any of the major cities in the world, is an enormous place. So I don't know if my film should be the predominant sample size. It's definitely one pocket of the city. And of course, it does say something about the air that is pervasive. But having said that, it's like the city provides a lot to different people. I, however, was interested in particular in two things. I was interested in the air, or, you know, when you live in the city of Delhi, the air is a constant preoccupation. It takes on a kind of gray, opaque, almost creepy sentience like tone, and I was interested in that kind of a texture of life in the city, that all laminating grayness, and apart from that, I was interested in thinking of the city through the lens of non-human life. So it started as a kind of abstract triangulation between air, birds, and humans. That was vaguely the web of things that I was interested in. And I happened to just one day Google where do birds that fall off the sky go to. And that's when I came upon the work of the two brothers, Nadim and Saud. And it's what they do is singular and remarkable. From this tiny, like you correctly said, small, decaying, grubby basement, they in the last.
I'm using your words. You described it as tiny, grubby, derelict basement. So,
well, it is entirely and utterly that. Those are the words that best describe that space.
Yeah, it's a small, grubby space for sure. And let me just, you know, these guys are making soap dispensers, but meanwhile, they're just dealing with literally hundreds of birds.
Right. That's like their day job. But in the last 15 years, they've treated over 25,000 black kites. And they do it for the most part, often fairly unsupported and of their own volition. And I was very interested in why they do what they do. But to not make something that was like a conventional nature doc or a wildlife doc, not to make something that was, you know, just a sweet film about nice people doing good things, but a kind of ecological, emotional, and socio-political history of the city and the state of affairs in Delhi through the relationship of this one remarkable family and this one raptor, this one bird called the black kite.
Well, let me take it back a couple of steps. I mean, you talked about seeing these raptors, these kites, just fall out of the sky. It's something that, you know, people see regularly in Delhi?
No, I wouldn't. No, that would be overstating it, certainly. Like, it's not like if you look up every now and then a bird pops down. That's not how it is. But, you know, it's a huge city. And if, say, 25 to 30 birds are getting injured and falling down, then, you know, it's not like people can regularly see it. In our 3 years, I've only seen it once in our 3 years of shooting. Having said that, the number is still staggering because the brothers get about, on some days, they get about 25 to 30 injured kites in one given day that have fallen down.
I did read that you had seen one of the birds fall and Googled it, but I also saw where you said that you had been reading a lot of literature about birds. The Peregrine by J.A. Baker, about this person who's following a peregrine falcon. And I think that also informed your feeling about making this film.
Indeed. Observing the birds only came in the wake of the great literature that I was often reading at the time. So essentially, I was in the UK for a fellowship at Cambridge, and I was basically housed in a department where a lot of people around me were working on human, non-human issues. So that was really the cloud of ideas. That was the broader conceptual force field around me. And I started reading a ton of books, you know, like Grief is a Thing with Feathers, H is for Hawk, The Peregrine, and a whole litany of excellent avian-related prose or fiction or nonfiction or poetry and so on. I wasn't a bird watcher prior to this. And then once I went to Delhi, I got more and more inspired by the figure of the black kite. And, you know, the picture postcard of Delhi is this dystopic gray monochromatic sky, especially in the winters, where you have these tiny black dots gliding in the sky. And these are the black kites that are lazily gliding often. And I was very fascinated by what one can do in terms of telling a ecological and a emotional and a sociopolitical story through the figure of the black kite.
Yes. So you're in this immersion with this literature. You see a bird fall. You look, and this is how you find these two brothers?
Well, I started researching on what happens to birds that fall off the sky. I basically wanted a kind of a moment of encounter between birds and humans. One way to go about it is the act of feeding, right? The other way is to look at this kind of slightly perverse moment where birds are falling off, and in this one claustrophobic tiny basement, these two brothers are like, you know, three tiny Don Quixotes just soldiering on. And to me, every single kite that flies off after getting injured from terrace enclosures is a bit of a micro miracle. And I was fascinated by their story, by what it allowed me to talk about in a more zoomed out, bigger sense, and also the sheer poetry of it.
It's clear from the film that money is a consideration for them. I mean, I'm not suggesting that you'd paid them, but for them, when you approached them, did they hesitate or did they immediately say, this can help us fund this work?
Well, it was both. Those are not obviously mutually exclusive binaries. So they were fairly media savvy in terms of giving quick media bites, because within a very niche environmental circle, their work is known. So they have given like small bite-sized interviews in the past. That was actually a challenge for me, because essentially what I had to do was to try and break them out of that, because we don't use talking head as a format, right, in the film. This is a kind of creative doc which It's a verite observational doc where the main ambition is to get a sense of everyday, quotidian, banal, mundaneness, right? That's where characters are being instead of behaving in front of the camera. So there was a lot of conversation about where the film will go, how it can help. But of course, it's not like I had all the ready answers then. And very often a film is like a fever dream. You know, when you start, you sort of jump off a cliff and it's a bit of a free fall. And I tried to explain everything that I knew at the time. But I will also say that at that time, I didn't know where the film would land. And everything that has happened with the film was utterly and entirely outside of my orbit of predictive reasoning as well. How it began was, you know, you have to wait for a critical mass of boredom. Like you have to wait for characters to reach a point of boredom with the camera where it's not an obtrusive presence. I am not an obtrusive presence. And they're aware of me, but they're also, you know, not self-aware enough to change their behavior. So you essentially have to wait for the first yawn.
They become inured to the whole thing. They just carry on. Well, let me just take a step back there. So you had made this previous film about the battle for people who are not housed in India to find places to sleep, as I understand that. Am I right about that?
Yes, that was looking at the city through the lens of sleep. This one is looking at the city through the lens of non-human life, or more particularly, the bird life. So in a way, if the previous film was about the horizontal axis, this one sort of started emerging in my head through the vertical axis.
And when you want to do this, where do you go to finance it from the beginning?
Well, to a ton of places. So the thing is that, of course, it's not easy to fund a nonfiction film, especially because, you know, it takes really long. It took me 3 years to shoot and edit this film. So I, in the beginning, started by applying to grants, and we got grants from Sundance, IDFA, Tribeca, Catapult, and so on. I was fortunate enough to meet our producers, Teddy Leifer at Rice Films in the UK. And after that, you're basically a pitching machine. You know, you go through a bunch of doc incubation labs. There's one in Calcutta in India, and a ton of other documentary pitching forums, which are like meat markets where you meet different producers, sales agents, and any and all kinds of stakeholders, be it broadcasters, distributors, and so on. So you keep pitching the film and you essentially show at times a 3-minute pitch video, like a sizzle reel, or you show a longer kind of a 10 to 15 minute demo reel. In that, the hope is to meet the perfect match in terms of a financier or another studio. And we had the good fortune of then coming into contact with Tangle Bank Studios, which is an American film studio. And they were the ones who are the financiers of the film.
I read somewhere where you said you had learned the distinction between good money and bad money in terms of film financing.
Well, that's crucial, isn't it? You know, money is almost never without a caveat, especially for an early career filmmaker. It's super important, at least for me at any rate, is to hold on to autonomy and creative sovereignty. And especially if it's not a formulaic film that is easy to pitch, you know, because ultimately it's everybody's loss if the film does not come out as the best version of itself. And therefore, you have to listen to the smaller, tiny voices in your head, which gets difficult if you don't have contractual autonomy. You know, I was in this kind of a dreamy situation with excellent producers between Rice Films and Tangle Bank Studios. So fortunately, we were able to hit a sweet spot.
Coming up after the break, Shaunak Sen talks about keeping his camera trained on his subjects in the midst of violent political protests in 2020. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.